I'd say what a pleasure it is to be here. And, I was totally intimidated by that competition. But it was still a chance. And I was thinking actually in the last second of the winners was reading, it reminded me of something that Clive would have mentioned to Paul was telling me about the sort of the history of readings in this wonderful venue, and he's saying that John Montague that started readings here many years ago.
40 years ago.
When I started to write, I wrote for his translation of the Hag of Bear that I'm sure some of you know John Montague did. But these were very memorable lines that I really liked. So God be praised that I misspent my days. I'm going to start with a draft, actually, a new poem. It's pretty much a raw draft, so you're always most enthusiastic about what you're writing at the moment. And I was... lucky enough last week to get to a great exhibition in London, Ice Age Art, and absolutely fascinated by these two beautiful little ivory swans which come from Siberia, and they could sometimes so a huge inland sea, Siberia, but anyway they're over 20,000 years old. Just like, isn't that just blow your mind? Somebody would have made a work of art. Some hunter-gatherer made a work of art 20,000 years ago. That's absolutely stunning. So, it still speaks incredibly eloquently to us. So this is two ivory swans. Two ivory swans fly across the display case as they flew across Siberian tundra 20,000 years ago, heralding soul on an inland sea. Their wings, their necks, stretched, vulnerable, magnificent. Their whooping set off a harmonic, and someone who stopped, looked up, registered the image of the great journeying bird, and with a hunter-gatherer's hand, carved their tiny white likenesses from the tusk of the greatest of land mammals, wore them for a while, or traded, or gifted them, before they were dropped down time's echoing chute, to emerge strong-winged, whooping, to fly across our time. It's a very different swan poem. I lived for many years in Galway City, and we used to go for a walk down Nimmo's Pier, and there was a very large flock of swans there, 100 swans. You're not supposed to write about swans, which is why I do what it's saying you're not supposed to do it. And anyway, the reason they look so well is that they spent a great deal of time grooming themselves, a huge amount of time. I've got the wrong page for this actually. Oh, no. Sorry, just bear with me one second. I have the right page. That's what you get for writing about something you're not meant to write about.
Why are you not meant to write about swans?
Well, because it's supposed to be sopping.
Oh, is it?
Oh, I thought it was that swan.
That's the vibe, as you say it too.
Save it till last. Then.
Yeah, I'm very tenacious. Swans of Nimmo's Pier. They are angels of their morning ablutions, more industrious by far, more hygienic, more conscientious than mortals. More than 100 oil and rummage their feathers. Nibble themselves vigorously under stomachs and wing pits, littering the shingle with white quills and breath down. But in the middle of this white fury, some sleep on, long, creamy necks coiled on their backs, heads folded under their own glorious wings. Most of these doze in the concrete slip, but a few sleep standing up, meringues balanced on grey feet. These dozers,
are Luciferian swans who, heads hidden under unlivered wings, think darkly, I will not scrub. Or perhaps they're less resolute, muttering in their angelic slumbers, O Lord, let my wings be well oiled, let me be love's free, but not just yet. driving down today from Galway, and it really is the most amazing time of the year, just, and everything's very yellow at the moment. The fields are dandelions, and the furze bushes are in bloom, but where I come from, where Anne comes from, we don't call them furze bushes, we call them quin bushes. And when we were kids at school, we were taught that there was only one synonym in the English language, furze and gorse. Only two words that meant exactly the same thing. And this was very bewildering. If you and everybody you knew around you called them puns instead. Quins, puns. Before we'd heard of Van Gogh, we'd felt the hit of that yellow when all the worst fields were rough brushed, overrun with a coconut scented bush. Barbed saffron, it trumpeted summer. To farmers, it was a bright curse, its root ball so tough and springy, my father as a boy had cut slitters from it. In May, it lit hills and headlands, brash, it invaded the earth. I'd know you on a whin bush in Australia, was said to someone unexpectedly met. But how were we supposed to greet in fifth or sixth class when we did at last meet the English language's first synonym, the English language's only synonym, furze and gorse, those lonely, identical twins. Title point in this collection is called Carrying Songs, and it is an epigraph from a wonderful traditional singer called Frank Hart, who he was a great collector of songs, but he used to say, he said, it's those in power who write the histories, but it's those who suffer who write the songs. And I was very struck by this a number of years ago. I spent a while in Canada, and I couldn't get over the fact that I came across songs there which I had learned as a child in Donegal, and they travelled over, in fact, to Scotland with migrant workers, and then they had travelled with immigrants to the Newfoundland and to Nova Scotia. And I just wondered why it always seemed to be the poorest people who carried the songs, and I wondered, was it because they, more than anybody else, needed to bring the emotional weather of their own country with them? And then I was thinking of other groups of people who carried music, famously the Jews who were exiled in Babylon, brought their songs with them there. And then you think of all the music, our 20th century music is completely indebted to the black slaves who were brought from Africa, who owned less than nothing. And all our rhythms come from them. But musician Jane Evomo told me she went up to Donegal to collect songs from her aunt, her blind aunt. And because this woman was blind as a young girl, she spent a lot of time with older people, and she had a huge collection of songs. But she also had lots of songs from her grandmother, because apparently when the young man was going to Scotland to work, they brought back presents for their girlfriends, and she always asked them to bring them back a song when she was asked what she wanted. And I thought it was wonderful that this great collection of songs was carried all over the world by her grandchildren. So, carrying the songs. It was always those with little else to carry who carried the songs to Babylon, to the Mississippi. Some of these last possessed less than nothing, did not own their own bodies. Yet, 3 centuries later, deep rhythms from Africa stowed in their hearts, their bones, carry the world song. And for those who left my county, girls from Downing's and the Rosses who followed herring boats north to Shetland, gutting the sea silver as they went, or boys from Renifast who took the Derry boat, who slept over a rope in a buffet, songs were their soul's currency, the pure metal of their hearts, to be exchanged for other gold, other songs, which rang out true and bright and flung down upon the deal boards of their days. Sometimes you think, you know, your life would have gone quite a different direction if you had done something very different. I would love to be an archaeologist in many ways. And I was intrigued one time, a few years ago, 10 years ago, I read an article by the art critic John Berger, and he was talking about the Chauvet Caves in France. Is anybody familiar with, anybody heard of them? They're like the Lascaux and Altamira caves, with these cave paintings, but before that people thought the earliest cave paintings were 18,000 years ago, which is not today or yesterday.
Yeah, I saw them.
You saw them?
They're amazing, yeah.
The Chauvet or the Altamira?
Were you going to the cave, the Chauvet?
Yeah. You've been there?
Yeah.
You've been in Chauvet?
I think so.
Oh, wow.
They're 40,000 or 20,000 or 40,000 years
they're,
old. They're the oldest.
They're the oldest.
Chauvet
been there?
Family,
you're
yeah.
very lucky. Almost nobody's been in there. Oh, I'm very, very envious. Was it wonderful?
Yeah. They have the shapes of the creatures painted over the shapes of the rock.
Exactly. That's
yeah,
it.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And there's some you can't see, like, behind,
yeah.
out
yeah.
of sight of, like, buffaloes and people.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
These were 32,000 years old, these paintings. I mean, it's just, I can't imagine back before this is 4,000 or 6,000. These were 32,000 years old. Well, his heart put it to me. He said, they're stunning. They're absolutely stunning. And he said, we don't draw any better now. And I thought this was very interesting. But, you know, and it reminds me of what the novelist Cyrus Murdoch said, that the arts do not progress in the same way as the sciences. That, she said, nobody's better than Homer. But anyway, this kind of blew me away to show me Kate. And I like that. Berger saying, you know, that the animals were in the cave, he said, you know, they were just... So, and it's exactly what Michelangelo said, you know, the sculptures were in the rock, you know, just let them out. And it's just about music or, you know, beautiful sculpture or whatever it is. Chauvet. One red line defining the rump draws a small mammoth out of the cave wall, renders him more than a static mite. In another chamber, a bear's paw protrudes, outlined in charcoal. The animals had been in the wall all along, awaiting recognition, release. The Stone Age artists knew it, just as the Italian master would know it, as his chisel unlocked perfect forms from Carrara's marble. As we know it, when some informed, deft gesture, a tilt in a melody, a lit line in a poem or a song, draws us out into our humanity, warm-blooded, bewildered. A few years ago, I was fortunate enough to be invited to Buenos Aires, and coming back anyway on the plane. And one of those moments that you occasionally get and say, you know, there's something rather odd about being up in an enormous piece of metal in the sky, you know. You take it for granted most of the time, but occasionally you get this sort of slightly wobbly moment. And in fact, it happened the same Air France flight went down the following year, but anyway, I didn't know that, and I'm not responsible. But anyway, you just begin to think of the responsibility, the incredible fact that you're in a hands pilot, and think of parallel situations. Hands. It was somewhere over the northeastern coast of Brazil, over Fortaleza, a city of which I know nothing, except that it is full of people, the life of each one a mystery greater than the Amazon. It was there, as a toy plane on a flight monitor nudged over the equator and veered east towards Marrakesh. But I started to think again of hands, of how strange it is in our lives, the life of the red-haired French girl to my left, the life of the Argentinian boy to my right, my life, and the lives of all the dozing passengers who have been carried fast in the dark over the darkened Atlantic. All of these lives are now being held in the hands of the pilot, in the consciousness of the pilot. And I think of other hands which can hold our lives, the hands of the surgeon, whom I meet again when I return home, the hands of the intelligent black-haired nurse who unwound the birth cord from my neck, the soft hands of my mother, the hands of those others who loved me, until it seemed almost as though this is what a human life is, to be passed from hand to hand, to be borne up improbably over an ocean. Great musicians.
Here.
Mindset.
Carry on.
And I thought I'd just read this for musicians in the audience. I'm sure they're here. It's called Songpost. I don't know how the chat came around one time, talking to somebody about fiddles. And, it was a friend of mine, actually, a musician was talking, but an old friend of his. He was collecting music from him, and this old guy talked about another friend, and he said, oh, his fiddle had this amazing tone, and he said it's because the sound post was made from a bird's bone. And I said, what's the sound post? He says it's usually a tiny piece of wood inside the, many of you know this, but I didn't, inside the fiddle or inside a violin. It's a little column of wood. Yeah. And are you the fiddler?
No.
No.
Next weekend is Baltimore. What is it? Fiddle Fest, by the way.
Yeah. Well, there'll be plenty of songposts there anyway. But this little piece of wood is terribly, terribly important. And it's positioned a little bit somewhere near the bridge. And terribly important where it's positioned, for the way in which it resonates. And anyway, I don't know, somewhere else in chat somebody said that in French it's called lamb, the soul of the... soul of the instrument, loving, and in Italian, the anima, it's the same soul. Soundpost. Its tone came from the soundpost. It was made from a bird's bone. A musician tells of his friend's fiddle, the one in which so many well-shaped tunes have been turned and played. In French, it is called lamb, the instrument's soul. In Cremona, when the master Lucier brought a supply of slow-growing timber down from the high Alps, to shape around his moulds, it was called l'anima, a round peg of wood positioned carefully inside the instrument, almost under the bridge, to hold apart belly and back, to gather every vibration of the strings, every lift and fall of the bower's wrist, to carry all that is in us of flight through the woods of the instrument.
Amen.
Short little poem called Two Doors. Portugal, really. We've just been shown around this beautiful old cathedral that was 1,000 years old. And the old man was showing us around, this old priest, but I thought what he said was lovely, actually. It's called Two Doors. There are two entrances to this house, the old priest told us this morning as he turned bright as a bird to the great oak door under the rose window. Through one door, the people come in. Through the other door, the light comes in, and the people are in the light, and the light is in the people. Few could have wished it otherwise. Yet in the cathedral's 1,000 years, so much else has come in the lower door, borne often by princes of church and state. Why, through the rose window, through thick dust, through spiders' webs, with their hordes of netted flies, the light still enters, limpid, constant. I am ignorant about many things, but I'm particularly ignorant about science, which is a source of great regret to me. However, when I, there is an upside to it. Occasionally, sort of he tells her something which is completely commonplace and well known to everybody else, and I'm totally wowed by it. This was called RNA, and I was visiting my sister some time ago, and I asked my nephew when he was studying equipment microscopy, he was working on the side, and I said, what's it on? And I said, micronucleic acid, I heard him say it, which short was RNA. I said, what's that? And he said, it translates DNA into protein. I said, it blew me away, the fact that the blueprint gets something, these little micronucleic acids, translate or they're instrumental in the process of changing our DNA blueprint into something that lives and walks and flies and swims and all the rest. So this is RNA. Last night on Easter Sunday, my nephew told me that messenger ribonucleic acids have the task of translating DNA into protein, that they carry a cell's blueprint to be made into fiber and flesh and bone. This morning, I woke up early, but lay on. My sister's garden was already wide awake. Above all the chirping and whirring, the blackbird's courting note rang out, a round gold coin. Astonishing. Astonishing to know that the throat muscles, the voice box, and the levitating architecture of hollow feather and hollow bone were coded in the blackbird's DNA. Translated by messenger ribonucleic acids, were made flesh, this particular scrap of singing flesh, which made this particular mating sound. you think at this stage you might have parallel lives or whatever, but I'd also love to be a musician. Say every poet is a failed musician. I think that's pretty true of me anyway. But anyway, you can't play, you can't sing, you listen to it. And it's about a concert very, very high in the mountains. There's this wonderful string quartet playing, and we're kind of late heading up, up these sort of very, very windy roads and sort of cranky humor, you know. And then you play this amazing music, you know. This came down feeling completely different. And it's just about what music does to us. How does it chart those bits inside of us that we're not able to access any other way? Then it's almost as if it maps our emotions, or whatever. And nothing else does. The wonderful Austrian poet Rainer Maria Rilke would say, "Music, it's the language where language ends." So there's night rolled in the mountains. The great black hulks of the Vosges rise, the Vosges are mountains in the east of France. The great black hulks of the Vosges rise so high that this midnight the plough's starry coulter is sunken in. Earlier, in the small crowded church of the upper valley, five musicians played for us, stood, bowed, and then played on and on, munificent as a mountain cascade in spring. We do not know, we do not understand how five bows drawn across five sets of strings by gifted, joyful hands can trace the back roads of our hearts which are rutted with doubts and yearnings, which are unpredictable as this ever-swerving mountain road down which we now drive, hugging the camber, informed by rhythm and cadence, happy to live between folded rocks and stars. Newer ones. Or at the end of the flight. A while in the States a few years ago, so some people don't come from there. At the end of the flight from Dallas to Philadelphia, the flight attendant announced that we had the father and sisters of a fallen soldier on board, that we were to remain seated until they disembarked, and that she had died honorably. There was a round of applause and another on landing, as a middle-aged man in a beige jacket stood and took down his hand luggage, a carrier bag with a corner of a folded starry flag poking out. And two young women in jeans rose from separate seats further forward in the plane. And we heard the sound of grief grinding three separate tunnels down all their days. This is unashamedly frivolous. It's about the importance of hairdressers. It just amazes me that in the earliest, you know, sort of archaeological digs, you'll find jewellery. You'll find weapons, and you'll find jewellery. And in the earliest sculptures, you find that, and burials, you'll find that people were very, very careful about how they did their hair. It seems to be answerably primal. The same fact that language may have evolved, and people, you know, it wasn't, but you know, there's a big buckle down to water holes, when people were grooming each other. Anyway, I live beside a hairdresser, a very old-fashioned hairdresser called Classic Hair Designs. Very often I see people leaving their mothers in, you know, and they're very, sometimes very, something terribly poignant about it. Classic Hair Designs. Every day they're dropped off at Classic Hair Designs. Sometimes in taxis, sometimes by daughters, often by middle-aged sons in sober coats, who pull in tight by the curb and stride around to the door and offer an arm. How important this last, or almost last, vestige of our animal pelt is. How we cherish it. The Egyptians' braided bob, those banded Grecian curls, the elaborate patterns of Africa, the powdered teetering pompadour, the 60s long shining fall over guitar, and the fine halo of my almost blind 92-year-old neighbour, permed and set in the style in which she stepped out with her young man after the last World War. Keats lives on the Amtrak. Yeah, Amtrak is probably, if you know, it's the American version of Here or There. It's a wonderful encounter one day. You know, you get, one day it's on the dumbest stage, you have the most fantastic encounters. Keats lives in the Amtrak. Today, on a clunking, hissing silver train between Philly and New York, the African-American conductor squeezed himself into the dining car seat opposite me, genially excused himself, and when I responded, asked why my novel was full of page markers. You've it all broken up, and I said that I was teaching it. He leaned forward, smiled, and said, I'm going to get a t-shirt with Keats Lives on it. This time of year, he gestured towards the train window where trees were blurring into bud. When everything starts coming green again, I always think of him. A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases. It will never pass into nothingness, but still will keep the bower quiet for us. I told him it was a Dublin taxi driver who first told me that Keats claimed his only certainties were the holiness of the heart's affections and the truth of imagination. He took a ballpoint from the pocket of his uniform jacket and wrote down the quote. And as where it came from, as I had 2 decades earlier in the back of a taxi, as hundreds had done, since a young, sick apothecary had penned it to his friends. That is a bombshell, he said. I'm going to give that to my little girl tonight. Oh, light winged drive. The intercom announced that the next stop was Trenton. And the steel wheels began their loud, long screams. He hauled himself up onto the seat, smiled again, and, drawing a line across his chest with his thumb, said, I'm going to get that t-shirt made that says, Keats Lives. Singing Horseman, a painting in the National Gallery by Jackie Yates, and a most gorgeous painting of this young man riding home by the sea, and he calls it's just called playing the singing horseman. He looks actually as if he's playing a whistle, but anyway, and his sleeve seems to be sort of red or torn or something, you know. And anyway, I discovered that Jack B. Yeats had painted it, W.B.'s brother. He painted it, he's quite an old man. And apparently he was very, very fond of he was very, very different to W.B. He was just fond of life, he was fond of the races, he was fond of boats, he was just fond of ordinary people. When he was a kid, he was sent back from London to live with his granny in Sligo. And W.B., he was about 7 years older, said, Jack is with my grandparents in Sligo at the moment, and he goes to the local grammar school where he's bottom of the class. And my grandmother is absolutely delighted with him and says he's much too kind to pass out the other boys. But Jack was spending his time very, very usefully, a very quiet fellow, but he spent a lot of time, as they go to the races, and hanging around the docks and watching the ships coming in. And he, of course, used it to great end later in his paintings. But he was a very old man, apparently, when this was a very late painting. And it's just so full of joy. And it's so full of what song means between the ages, to me anyway, between the ages of about 18 and 26, when song just meant everything. The Singing Horseman. The white horse with its golden chest and head is from another world. It's kin to wide-winged Pegasus, or to the white horse that carried Ushinog, or to the black mare of Fanid who saved her rider from a demon. But this golden-headed rider is one of us, a young man with a torn red sleeve jogging home bareback from the races on a breezy summer's evening at Sligo, riding near the rough blue shore, heading north towards Streeta, playing a whistle or singing. And the painter who paints them both is an old man who remembers 100 races, 100 summer's evenings. But how are we who do not believe in magic steeds to understand this, except to remember the years between 15 and 22 when our spirits strained as a moth's wings strain inside its brown spun prison, when a song pressed into black vinyl by some Dylan seeking his direction home, or sung by an acquaintance at a party who gave voice to some long dead passion, released our crumpled spirits, transported us across skies and oceans, and our hands, our heads, were golden, golden. Yeah, sometimes, I was in Galway last night, I was heading off today about lunchtime, and I went to look for my folder of poems. I couldn't find them anywhere, and I said, oh gosh, I left them in Ronson days ago, what am I going to do, you know? But of course, with the wonders of modern technology, it's very easy, you just got them out, printed them out of the computer again, you know? So I said, the computer is a truly wonderful thing, but sometimes it brings up very interesting facts about, you know, the way you can look up your ancestors, etc. Sometimes you find very unusual facts. I saw something noted recently that distant ancestor of mine, or somebody with my name anyway, surname, Turlough O'Callaghan in the 11th century, had pillaged Lough Derg in County Donegal and carried away its gold vessels. He had another abbey himself, he was just doing a bit of shopping. And of course, he came to that end. So, anyway, I called this. So, this is fascinating with these things that you actually come across quite by accident. And so we can hide nothing about our ancestors anymore, actually, with the internet, etc. I was quite intrigued. So, this is called www.annalsofulster.com. When my ancestor pillaged the sanctuary of Lough Derg in the 11th century and carried off its gold vessels, he could hardly have foreseen that letters put down carefully by some tonsured scribe would light up on a screen 1,000 years later. How could he have known the power of an inked feather, of the quartz seam ticking under a heaven? Okay.
anybody wants anything?
Yeah.
Water.
Okay. Would I wait until you come to the last call, or will I?
No.
Okay. Please understand why I have to catch that. This is just sort of a beehive, sort of a deep fall of snow on them a few years ago. And I was thinking of the side of bees lines that you know nothing about. Just as you know, people who you sort of see about you all the time, and you haven't a clue really what's going on in people's private lives. It's about hanging in, actually. Anyway, and thank you very, very much. I just want to say what a pleasure it's been reading here tonight, and to thank Paul and Sue and all the people who organised it and all the hard work, and to you for listening. It's such a lovely audience. So, bees under snow. In a valley beside the Blackwood, this year there are 52 beehives, orange and blue cubes with zinc lids, raised on long girders. Last winter, under a foot of snow, they were square marshmallows in a white field. By a minuscule door lay a few dead bees, and one or two flew about distractedly. But the bees inside hovered in a great ball, shivering to stay alive, moving always inwards towards the globe's centre, or outwards towards its surface. And much of their hunt for sweetness, or their incidental work of fertilising the world's scented myriad-coloured flowers to bear fruit for all earth-bound, airborne creatures. This is part of their lives, these long months of shivering of bee faith. Thank you.